Pre-recording, and I'll try to cover perhaps a little bit. Did anyone have any other ideas for lectures, by the way?
Could you go over TR switching?
There's a question on the exams on that. Yeah, no worries.
How many lectures?
By the way, I don't know that I need to do that because I've almost finished the solutions to those problems on the web, and it's up there again.
Okay.
Now, if you want, I can post the solutions before I quite have everything finished, and the solution's already there. In fact, you should find the solution to the previous exam that asked that question as well, already on the web. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so you still have problems with it?
I don't understand the concept.
Oh, right, okay. Well, maybe we should deal with that in the tutorial tomorrow. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's...
That's accessible, isn't it?
It is accessible. It's been in previous years' exams. Yeah. But it's also been in many exams, so...
Yeah, well, so it's probably got a low probability of appearance.
Are we going to have like an actual revision section, or just whatever we want you to talk about?
What do you mean by revision section?
Well,
I sort of planned on doing that, but Ada's proposed that I just redo transmission lights. Everyone sort of agree with that?
Yeah, but that's one slide out of like, you know, how many. It's not really, it's a revision on transmission lights.
Yeah,
you know, but not a revision.
Well, the only other thing I can think of doing is going over the whole course again and very quickly to find out to give you an idea of what is accessible.
Yeah.
So you get a better idea by reading the problems. There are quite a few of them. There's probably all 20 of these problems, and the solutions I will provide in quite a bit of detail. So if you can do those, then you should have no fear for the exam. Okay.
Oh, they're the ones you just put up on the web.
Yeah, I put them up on Friday.
Yeah,
who's downloaded and had a look at them?
So you reckon that's going to be enough material? Or how many questions do you plan to put in the exam?
Same as previous years, I can't remember.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a 3-hour exam, so have a look at, I think last year's exam will give you, I'm on the director on last year's exam. Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, it's up to, if you think the questions are going to be enough, that's fair enough.
Yeah,
that's
right.
I reckon it's probably be nice.
A summary of the course.
A summary is fine. Just a lot of refresh the whole brain.
Yeah. You can sort of get an idea of what you need to know, for example, about electromagnetism from the first two or three questions in the problem suite. I think it's the first year I've actually set any real problems on electromagnetism in an exam or in a problem set. Okay, so you have a look at those and you get a gist of those. The other thing that hasn't appeared before is, I think, satellite link budgets. Okay, because there's a bit more in the course perhaps this year than in previous years. But if you have a look at the problems on the web, I think that should solve all your ideas. I've already done the solution to the first question on the web, which came straight out of...
So they're like work solutions or something?
Yes. The whole thing. Yes. Yes.
Is the exam question going to be annoying with the whole inner question, subsequent path or required the first part?
Yes, they could well do. But within parts of questions, probably more likely. So
oh,
if you've got four,
like 1A,
yes, that sort of question.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, you can't do A, but you could have done B.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it depends on how basic it is or how tough the question's going to be. Yeah.
We could just make up answers. If you didn't get A, it was quite a
I do mark that term conveniently. Yeah, if you didn't get the answer in A and you were meant to compute a value in part B, but if you still got the formula right in part B, then you get full marks. Okay. All right, so we'll look at transmission lines. Transmission lines were useful in this course for understanding, first of all, what you read out of your spectrum analyzer when doing impedance measurements. And so I guess what we've got 2 weeks to go now, and essentially full-time labs. So if you wanted to, you've got all your questions to do, your problems to do, then you should get stuck into it in this last 2 weeks and have those finished. And the other thing is, how many people have made progress with the report so far? You may have done a bit of work. Who hasn't started it yet? Right.
You haven't told us the sequence of what you want yet.
I am going to do that, but my answer, as always, is that I don't think it's important for me to tell you the sequence. I want to see what you know. Okay, you've got 30 pages, which is a lot of space to express what you know. So, I mean, you wouldn't be told how to present things in any other situation, like a research situation or a company situation where you're presenting a report to your employer. You wouldn't be told what to present. It's up to you to know. You're the one who knows. You're the one who knows, not me. And you're the one who knows what you know, not me. Okay? But I'll give you a very quick summary. I'll post on the web as soon as I can emerge from my current state of drowning with respect to admin and put it up for you. But it won't be very much. But you've really got to start writing on it as soon as possible, okay? That was always the assumption.
What date is this all due?
What's the 2nd of June?
The 2nd of June is a Saturday.
Yeah, so the Monday after that'll be good.
So the
4th of June.
Okay, cool.
Sorry, the 4th of June, yeah.
So that goes for the exercises?
That, strictly, that's in the exam period, so I hope you don't worry too much about it.
That's better.
You like it better that way. Maybe you're missing a weekend to study exams, but
that's maybe, but
it's up to you.
This will be like studying anyway.
So that's
for the problems and the report?
Yes, a whole lot in that one. Yeah. Okay, so that report, and hand in your logbooks and your scrapbooks. And we know we've had discussions about scrapbooks before. I'll look at the logbook and see what I think, okay? All right. Okay, transmission lines. All right. We had an introduction to the telegraphist equations. We had the concept of waves on transmission lines in this lecture. Reflection coefficient, transformation of voltage and current and impedance along the line. None of those formulae do you have to remember for the exam. And then I'll mention it as we get along, and we'll look at maybe some applications of transmission lines. Now, the magic thing about transmission lines, you may remember in this, is that somehow you had a long wire for which you've been previously calculating inductances and capacitances, inductance along the line and capacitance across the line, and then all of a sudden you terminated in this number, this real number, the characteristic impedance of the line, and all of a sudden the input impedance at this point is always equal to the characteristic impedance, provided this terminating impedance is the characteristic impedance of the line. Okay? And this was the solution to transporting energy at radio frequency. Alright. And there are many different lines. The most common one you've seen in the lab is coaxial cable, of course. A 50 ohm transmission line. And the other common number we found in the lecture on antennas was 75 ohms, because that's roughly like the real part of the radiation impedance of a dipole antenna, which was 72 ohms, okay? Transmission lines must always have two parallel conductors, right? And that's important, because when you have two parallel conductors, then the current going in one direction and the current going in the other are theoretically assumed to cancel in a kind of idealization of the way this thing operates. They cancel, thus producing no radiation from the line at all. So they're like two parallel antennas that have no net radiation. Now, if you only had one wire there, there's no way you could cancel that current. There'd always be a net current. And as we've now seen retrospectively, that's an antenna, okay? Such a system is an antenna. I'll get onto that later. Okay, so at low powers, coaxial cable is often flexible, okay, such as the RG58 cable you have in the lab. You go to higher powers, polythene is the dielectric used in coaxial cable. In addition, there are other dielectric materials, including Teflon, and semi-rigid cable with a rigid jacket or return conductor is common for higher powers and lower loss cables, whereas the flexible cables always have a braided outer conductor, and that of course leads to leakage of radio frequency signals as well. And you can also, the other common type you're going to meet, as one person in this class, or you've all had to meet to a degree or think about to a degree, are that when you make a track on a PCB at sufficiently high frequencies, of course, you have to be worried about whether that track is a transmission line and that you terminate it in its characteristic impedance. And you can make such a transmission line by tracks on the PCB. And you call those strip lines.
All right, so properties of transmission lines. There's no net current that flows along the line. In coax, current flows along the outside of the centre conductor and on the opposite in the opposite direction on the inside of the outer conductor. And so that's the way that they achieve their shielding effect. I don't think they have any hands of bringing it. But so you imagine you've got a centre conductor of coaxial cable and an outer pipe that represents the return conductor. The current flows on the outside of the inner conductor. Why is that? Good effect, yes, absolutely. Remember that radio frequency fields can penetrate at most a skin depth into any conductor. And in an earlier lecture on electromagnetism, it was also shown that there can never be any net charge inside any conductor at all. Charge must always live on the outside of a conductor, and we had this really ridiculously small time for the amount of time that a charge could live inside a conductor of about 10 to the minus 19 seconds. But when currents are flowing and inductive effects, that is changing magnetic field effects, occur, you can also have the skin effect and there's a penetration of electromagnetic waves inside conductors. So that also means that if you've got a big centre conductor, like a 1-inch diameter pipe, for example, you don't have to make the pipe out of solid copper, you can just make it out of, well, a 30 megahertz, and a skin depth, I guess, about a micron, so that makes it a very thin foil, is all you need to make it. The only consideration you need to take into account is if power deposition within the resistivity of the centre conductor, and if your foil is too thin, then the conductor might overheat and go red hot. And on the outer conductor, you have another pipe, and similarly, the return current, which is equal and opposite everywhere along the line in the outer conductor, penetrates only a distance. The skin depth delta into the outer conductor, and so propagates on the inside of the outer conductor. In a coaxial cable, the electric fields point radially, meaning outward from the centre conductor to the outer conductor, and the magnetic field lines circle the inner conductor. Okay, and there is no component of electrical magnetic field along the transmission line. It's called a TEM mode, transverse electromagnetic mode. And there are lots of applications of transmission lines. We've seen them. Now, you haven't actually seen them yet for impedance transformation. That's an interesting exercise to be able to do. One student has met it in their project. He's not here today. Impedance transformation. You can make elements directly out of them using... You can make transmission line transformers directly out of transmission lines. In fact, arguably, the windings on any transmission line transformer are transmission lines. They're not necessarily coaxial, but... They might be bifilar or trifilar windings. Filters, you can certainly make filters out of coaxial cables because they are highly reactive elements. DC block, I showed you a picture of one. That might even still be here. And antennas as well. So there's a picture of the electric and magnetic fields. The electric field's in green, the magnetic field in blue for a twin wire line and a coaxial cable. All right. Now, the planar transmission line. Now, we've already done a derivation for plane waves, okay? I probably should go straight onto the telegraph's equations rather than these guys. Did I do that? Oh, that's how I did it. Yeah, okay. All right, so what we have is we have two curves, gamma and zeta, okay? And the first equation there is, who can recognise what law we're applying there in that first equation at the top? It's Faraday's law, exactly. You can recognise it by the derivative with respect to E. That is, really have messed up, haven't I? Not bringing a pen of any kind. But anyway, Faraday's law, remember, the way that law works is... That looks like a differential equation up there, and I haven't given you really differential equations in this course. Good on you. Right. All right, so the circulation of E dot dl around a closed curve, in this case gamma, okay, is equal to minus d phi b dt.
okay, where phi b is the integral of the magnetic field over the area of that surface. So the picture is simple. It's so general and pleasing to look at that it's hard to believe that it's true. There's a gamma, the curve, okay? It's just a locus in three-dimensional space. And A is any area at all that bounds gamma, so the easy one to draw here is the one in the plane of the whiteboard, okay? Righto, so that's A. Now what the picture here is, where this curve gamma, by the way, is not necessarily coinciding with any conductor, although it may well do, okay? In fact, we're just talking about free space here. We've been dreaming up curves in our dreams. And here's this gamma, which is a line, a closed line, and A, which is the surface. The electric field is taken along the contour gamma, and the magnetic field now points out of the board, actually. Okay? And what you're doing is multiplying B, this is a dot product here, by each of the area differential elements along the surface. You take the dot product with A, which is B dA cos theta, where theta is the angle between the magnetic field at that point and the normal to the surface, to the area. You've got the picture? And then you do that integral, and that gives you what's called the magnetic flux. Okay? So is everyone satisfied, at least, that they can picture what this is doing? Do you? Yeah? Everyone? Everyone happy with this crazy formula? Understanding what it means is all you have to do in this course. There are going to be relatively few circumstances, except for those with symmetry, where you can use it for a quantitative purpose. This is one of them, by the way. So, all right, so let's look at that. Righto, this is our curve gamma, and this transmission line, here it is seen from the cross-section, and you can see the magnetic field lines there in blue, and the electric field lines are in green, and you can see we have this curve, this is a picture of it from the side, so we're looking at it as the wave propagates along, and the propagating wave has been represented by the change in arrows here. You see, imagine the electric field being the displacement along the skipping rope as it moves along the rope. You can see those arrows. Without changing that picture at all, just move along between the orange lines, okay? All right, so what you have is a magnetic field here. They're turned out in black for some reason, these field lines. The magnetic field lines, as you can see there, are pointing outward. So what we have is the electric field at this point. May as well write this out. Okay, so we're going to apply that law there. The electric field is normal here, so E dot dl is zero. So at the point displaced along the line, E of z plus dz, we have D as the line element, if you like, integrated fully along there, although we can let that be dy, which is y, it's gamma dy, so dy minus E of z dy. So if we take that element there being dy, we have the electric field in the z, it's the electric field in the x in the y direction, which is upward, okay, and the z direction is the direction of propagation, and so E of y here is a function of z, okay. So I better put an ey on that, so we don't get too confused. So we have ey dy, because dy is the element where we're taking E dot dl here. So if dl points in the y direction, then ey is parallel to L here and here, but there's EY here, but the DL is now pointing in the Z direction, so we have no contribution to the dot product. And that will equal minus phi B dt, which is the magnetic field B of B is in the x direction because B is pointing out of the board, so all we have to do is take the B in the centre there and multiply that by, well, first of all, we have a j omega because we have a divinity t there, so we've got minus j omega V, and V is in the x direction, by dy dz. Okay? And there we have our first equation, all bar a minus sign, of course. That's because it was minus j omega. Okay? So that's now dEz, just use this as dEy dz, dz by dy is now j omega bx dy dz. Okay? And I've just represented that as E and B up there. So there's your first equation. And that's obtained from the symmetry of that transmission line and using Faraday's law. Everyone follow that? I did it from first principles enough then. Yes, sir.
I think there shouldn't be a dz there in the left-hand side of the equation.
Shouldn't be a dz. No. Yes, there should, because that's E of y of z plus dz
minus,
okay. Minus E y of z, so which is dE y dz dz.
So what's on the right-hand side of the equation? Dy dz? J omega.
This? J omega bx dy dz, yes. That's dy/dz, yeah. That's dy/dz, yes. It's dy/dz because dy/dz is the area bounding gamma. That's why. So, and I've just taken, this is a typical Leibniz-style differential analysis, okay? Right, you got that? Vikas.
Could this be asked in the exam?
No. Not this. Yeah. All right, going on with the proof. Yeah, I don't think there's any. Who's looked at the problem so far? Yeah, okay. Well, not in there, are they? No, okay. But there are problems on electromagnetism, though.
Yeah, but yeah. The applications.
Yeah, applications of it, yeah. All right, so next one. Where do you think the next equation comes from? Abbott. Shouldn't ask Abbott. Somebody else. Where do you reckon we derive that second equation? The one dBZ equals?
That's
Ampere's law, exactly. Ampere's law is very similar to this one. Should have to do it over here. Assuming everyone's going to see it. Well, this is just describing electromagnetic fields in a vacuum. Okay, so we have the integral of B dot dl. Now, normally that would be equal to mu naught I, but there is no current in the vacuum here, right? We're going to use this curve zeta as our closed circuit this time, and zeta actually lies in the xz plane. So it's drawn there in profile, but it's really into the ball, in the plane of the board, right? And that'll be equal to 1 over c squared d phi e dt, where I guess I've taken v to be the speed of light there. Right, our very similar formula, that's the electric flux now, and that by definition is the same as before, the integral of e dot dA over a bounding surface A, which bounds the curve zeta, okay? So exactly the same derivation there will lead to that equation. I think that's right. It looks like I might be missing a minus sign, but anyway, it's fine. Okay. Rightio. Now, won't go through that derivation again. Yes?
How do you get the direction of the magnet?
Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. It's a good question. Is he going to follow his derivations? He might as well do it properly, I suppose. It comes from this line integral. It's not the magnetic field that's important. It's the area that's important that bounds the surface, and it's the right-hand screw rule.
Yeah, could you show it on
Right, okay. In the gamma situation, in other words, Faraday's law.
How did you get those dots?
because I did a right-hand screw rule this way. X, where's Y? Now, X has got to be into the board. X has got to be into the board, hasn't it? If Y is upward, X is into the board for Z to go that way. That's a right-handed coordinate system. That's the first thing. The second thing is that you must do this. I should have done this integral. I don't know if I did, actually. But I should have done this integral with my thumb pointing in the X direction because I want A to point in the X direction. That means I should have done the integral around this way. That means that the curve gamma has direction, right? When you draw gamma like this, if the x axis is into the board, then the curve gamma would be performed this way. That means that E dot dl is evaluated with respect to elements dl that point along the arrows here. That's the answer to your question, okay? Actually, you might go through this in much more detail with you later, because I fear now what I'll do is I'll go back and do this and I'll stuff up a sign or something. That's my fear, because I'm pretty sure I'd get it right, but I want to get through the lecture too. Can we discuss that later? Does that appeal to everyone? We can discuss it in the tutorial tomorrow if you like. Remember that for me?
Yep.
Is that all right,
yep.
Abbas? Yeah, okay. All right, so going on now, we can define a potential difference in this situation. Because the electric field, the integral from one point to another of E dot dl is in fact unique in this transmission line by its symmetry. So you can define a potential difference between the upper and the lower plate. And it's E times D. Remember, D is the difference between the plates, the distance between the plates. You can also calculate B from I. It's related directly from Ampere's law because the magnetic field's also uniform. We have a relationship mu naught I over W. And therefore, you can now rewrite these two equations by substituting for V and I, as I've done there. And so we end up now with some numbers expressing the properties of the wave. That omega over K is the phase speed, and that's plus or minus the speed of light. And it's given by this formula, where epsilon R would have been the relative permittivity of the dielectric in between the transmission lines, okay?
What's W?
And W is the width of the line.
Okay.
Yeah. You notice that there is a problem with this. It really does assume that the transmission line's infinitely wide, and so it's behaving perfectly as a uniform, with a uniform current, electric and magnetic field distribution. And if that's the case, then the characteristic impedance of a wave is given by this formula. So that's Z naught. Okay. Now, for a transmission line of that's truly finite in width, in other words, this is not infinite. That formula is approximate. Okay. Obviously. So, the reason for this exercise in doing this derivation was just to show you. I guess a coaxial transmission line would have given an exact result, but with about 20% more mathematics to do it, but the conclusions are exactly the same, okay? At least the verbal conclusions, the formulae are not the same. But for a wave travelling in one direction only, the ratio of V to I is a constant for a transmission line. And if you think about that, that means that you've got this voltage wave propagating along, and there's a current that follows it, and it's in phase, because Z naught's a real number. Okay, we've got it down there. If epsilon R is real, there's no attenuation, which will be caused by an imaginary part to epsilon r. D and W are just distances. And so Z naught is a real number. Okay? All right. And we call it the characteristic impedance. The planar transmission line strip line, that you know. Yes, and the characteristic impedance can be complex, okay, if the dielectric material separating the conductors is lossy. And what that means is that it causes a phase shift between V and I, but it also causes an attenuation of the line because it makes the phase speed complex as well. If you go back here, the formula for V is now complex as well. And as we've seen in an exercise on the web, that leads to attenuation. In other words, the wave disappears if it propagates long enough, far enough along the line. All right, then The usual way you'll see all of this appear in transmission line books, and the derivation of the telegraphist equations is actually slightly different to what I've given you, where they use the distributed version of a transmission line instead of doing it from the electromagnetic point of view. And so with the previous equations that I've just derived can be written like this, okay? dV dz equals I omega z naught on V times I, and dI dz is I omega over z naught V times the voltage. And there's another derivation in the Webrick. Okay, then you can replace these quantities, z naught over V, by a quantity referred to as the inductance per unit length of the transmission line, and the quantity 1 over z naught V, which is the capacitance per unit length of the transmission line. So we have two parameters that are entirely equivalent to characteristic impedance and velocity, namely inductance per unit length and capacitance per unit length. And you can see by solving that, and I'll probably do it on the next view graph, that the formulae for... we have the following formulae, okay? That the velocity is given by 1 over the square root of LC, and Z naught is given by square root of L over C, all right? And these inductances and capacitances for any type of transmission line can be derived, and they really do mean, have the physical meaning you would expect. For example, if you had a coaxial transmission line, which was very short in comparison to a wavelength and open-circuited at one end, say of length L, then you would expect it to have a capacitance given by CL, where C is the capacitance per unit length of coaxial transmission line. Of course, you know also that if this is very long, then that's no longer true, because now you have to take into account finite wavelength effects, and there will be a reflected wave from the end of the line. So there's nothing further there. Oh, yes. I've put down the formula here for the coaxial case. You can see if you'd gone through the derivation I previously gave you, you end up with slightly more complicated formulae here for the capacitance and the inductance. But at least these ones are exact. The ones up there are idealised for the purposes of demonstration of a derivation. Well, they also apply when W is large compared to D, but these formulae here are exact for any values of B and A, where B is the inside diameter of the outer cable, the outer conductor, and A is the outside diameter of the inner conductor. Okay? Right. Now, reflection coefficient. This is the main thing that is important about transmission lines, the fact that they support wave motion. And wave motion is inevitable at radio frequency because the speed of light is finite. And the whole point of studying transmission lines is so you would know how you could transmit electromagnetic energy from one system to another over a large distance compared to a wavelength. One way to do it is to radiate it, of course, by an antenna, but then you lose all your power and go somewhere else. The transmission line allows you to transmit the power free of not only power loss, but also without distortion. Okay, and so at any point along a transmission line, there are going to be two waves of the type that I just derived. I only considered the forward wave in the previous derivation, so the transmission line was infinitely long. And you put a single generator at one end of the line that launches a wave which never comes back, provided the transmission line maintains its integrity and is infinite in length. And in general, if you terminate a transmission line in some load, you will also get a wave that propagates back in the other direction. And you can easily suspect that if you just turn a transmission line around in the other direction, the forward wave is now going in the other direction. So all the laws of physics are going to apply to it. And so there are really two waves that exist in any transmission line system, the forward and the backward wave. Okay? And so you can just add the voltages of each of those individually. And the relationships between the forward voltage and the forward current, the reverse voltage and the reverse current, are exactly what you'd expect. First of all, if Z naught is the characteristic impedance and it's a positive number, then for the forward wave, we've already seen that V
VF over IF gives you Z0, okay? However, for the backward wave, the one we didn't treat, there's a slight trick, and now, because the main point to notice is that if you've got a forward wave like that, travelling on a coaxial transmission line, and the voltage is positive, let's say there, the relationship VF equals Z0IF means that if the voltage is positive here between the outer conductor, which is a circular, and the inner conductor, then the current must be pointing in the direction of propagation. On the other hand, if you do the same thing for the reflected wave, where the voltage is positive on the centre conductor, if the wave's going that way, the current must be pointing that way, and therefore that explains the minus sign that we get here. Okay? All right? So with those formulae, you can now do anything with transmission lines. And the first thing is reflection coefficient. Reflection coefficient is simply a complex number which describes how much reflected wave you get when you put a particular load at the end of a transmission line. We all know that the reflection coefficient is zero if we terminate with a characteristic impedance of the line. Okay, so the derivation is quite simple. The voltage on the load is given by the impedance of the load times the current in the load, and we've just shown that these are given by IF plus IR and VF plus VR. And we know that the rate IF can be replaced by VF over Z0, and IR replaced by VR minus VR on Z0. So we have this equation, and then what we need, we define the reflection coefficient as the ratio of the reflected to the forward voltage, and we end up with this formula here for the reflection coefficient. And it has the expected result that if ZL happens to be equal to Z0, there is no reflected wave, and rho is zero. On the other hand, a line that's terminated in a pure reactance always has mod rho equal to 1. All right. It looks like I didn't derive this, so maybe I should do that sometime too, maybe in the tutorial tomorrow. The impedance at the input to a transmission line. Now, remember I was saying that, well, you've got this wave propagating along the line, and if you have an impedance ZL at the end of the line, you get a reflected wave. Well, the consequence of having that reflected wave means that if you measure the impedance at any point along the line, back from the load, you don't get ZL. You get some other Z, and it won't be Z0, because Z0 would mean that you had ZL, ZL equal to Z0. And so if you derive, as I should, the input impedance of a transmission line, then you end up with this formula here, which looks rather complicated, but it makes a lot of sense. K here, by the way, is the wave vector, omega over V. Confusingly, L is the length of the line, not the inductance of any kind here. It's the length of the line, as it has to be. Because that's a tan function, that has to be a dimensionless quantity. So K is 2 pi over lambda, so that has no dimensions. If ZL equals Z naught, then you can see the numerator and the denominator cancel, and we end up with Z in equal to Z naught, which is exactly what we'd expect. And there are a few interesting cases that arrive, special cases. If we have a short-circuited line, then Z in is given by this. And if we have an open-circuited line, then Z in is given by this formula, Z naught on J tan KL. And you can see when the frequency is zero, or L is zero, then the input impedance here is zero, as it should be when ZL is zero. And similarly, if L is zero, the input impedance is infinite, as it should be if we have an open circuit. Okay? So this formula here gives the right results in the different limits. And the other thing to realise, if you look at the way the tan function behaves, then you can see that a short-circuited line that's a quarter of a wavelength long, where KL equals pi over 2, because if KL equals pi over 2, and K is 2 pi F over V, right, omega over V times L, then And that means that L is equal to V over 4F, and V over F is lambda, so it's a quarter of a wavelength long. Okay. When that happens, when the line is a quarter of a wavelength long, then a short-circuited line now has tan pi over 2, which is infinite. And so that means that the input impedance is now infinite. So that means if you take... There is an exercise in the labs to demonstrate this. If you haven't done that exercise, that's a 30-second chance to understand it. But if you have a short-circuited line, coaxial cable terminated in a shorting stub or a shorted bit, like one of those soldered over N-type connectors that we have, then the input impedance of the line is infinite when it's a quarter of a wavelength long. So that's one way, for example, that you can measure the characteristic of the length of the line. Also, an open circuited line is a short circuit for the same reason, because 1 over tan KL would be 1 over infinity, which is 0. But there's something even more interesting about it, perhaps, that comes out of this. Oh, there's another thing. What happens if the line is a half a wavelength long? Okay? If the line's a half wavelength long, then KL is pi, and we get the same result. And in fact, you should be able to see that up here. If tan KL is 0, which occurs when you're a half wavelength long, then Zn is equal to ZL. So lines that are half wavelength long reflect the impedance back into itself. Okay? Now, let's suppose we have a line that's a quarter of a wavelength long. This is the interesting result. Then, when the line's a quarter of a wavelength long, tan KL is infinite, and so we end up with Z naught squared over ZL. Okay? Z naught squared over ZL. And so you have this interesting result that, well, first of all, if you have a certain load impedance, which is, let's say, a resistor, then by correctly choosing Z naught, you can match it to Z in. If Z in wants to have this impedance. So to give you a concrete example, suppose we have two transmission lines. One of them is a 50 ohm characteristic impedance line, and the other one's a 75 ohm line. Then if I connect the transmission line directly between them, whose characteristic impedance Z naught is the square root of 50 times 75, then that system will be matched. The 75 ohm impedance here will look like 50 ohms from here because of this formula. Do you see that? Because Z naught is equal to the square root of Z in times ZL, which if you have 50 and 75, I don't know what it comes out to be, maybe 62 ohms, I'm not sure. But this has to be a quarter of a wavelength long. And we get this transformation. And you can see if ZL is 0, then we end up with corroborating the case of infinity. And when it's infinite, correspondingly 0.
Okay, so I don't know how far I got there. Transformation along the line, hybrids, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Oh, yeah, nothing. Just some interesting things I could talk about in the next lecture, but... This is the next most important thing. You don't have to remember that formula, right? The complicated one. On the other hand, I think it's reasonable to have these stored in the back of your mind in this course, the simple ones about what... Because when you're thinking about that question that Vikas asked before about the pin diode TR switch...
Yeah,
the exercise you're referring to on the web and the one in the exams... That, same old question management here, two exams and on the web, is a special case of where you're trying to improve the open circuit or the short circuit using quarter wave stubs, just like that. Right? However, the one in your project, you don't do that, you just use the straight diode short circuit and open circuit. Okay?
Yeah, I went to the link you gave in the pin diodes and I read all the stuff but I couldn't answer the question still, so.
Okay. Oh, well, show me that. Show me that. Yeah.
There are different switches in the link.
Yes.
It's not similar to the one you've given us in the question.
Yes.
It doesn't. I couldn't answer that one still.
Mm. Okay.
So
oh, we'll sort that out in the tutorial then. Okay. All right. So that's it. The only
thing I'll cover it up. I'll cover it in next lecture is how to transform general voltages and currents along a transmission line, and that's also not to be memorised in the exam. Questions?
Len.
Oh. Oh, I think it's going overboard, isn't it? Yeah. What I'll do is I'll do a lecture on covering the whole course, I think, because this is just one lecture, right? Somebody wanted me to summarise all of Luke wanted to summarise the whole course, yeah.
Sorry?
Yes.
What do you want?
Spacing and margin.
Margin on the RF.
You mean formatting?
Yes.
Oh, I don't care. Impress me. Is there a reason?
Well, I don't know what standard
is. I don't have a standard. I just want to see what you know. I'm sure that if you work for a company later on, then making it look pretty like a public service document might be an acceptable thing to do. But I don't. Is that a worry? Does that mean you can cram more into your pages if you have a wider margin than a narrow? I'm not going to mark it.
We don't have a problem with having too many pages.
Yeah.
Too many.
No, we don't.
You have to write up
to show me what you know, and if what you show me can be written on a postage stamp, then that's fine. That's fine.
Sorry, I don't get you, Liam.
Generally, if you have a set margin and a set length,
yes.
You usually have a set one.
You do. I always get impressed by other people do and wonder why I can never do as well myself. Yes, L's. Yes, that sounds like a good thing to do in the next lecture, maybe?
The example on the Raspberry, I don't understand that one.